Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Welcome, everyone, to the War Report. And for those of you who are new to us, we welcome you as well. Today's show is sort of an emergency kind of show in that something took place this past Friday that created a major storm across the internet. It just took everyone, I think, by surprise, and the reaction to it has been fast and furious, and it was the result of an article that was posted, I think, Friday midday by a rather famous journalist who we happen to have as our guest today on the show, and I'm going to sort of like keep you in the dark, although if you've been following all of our promotions, you know who it is and what we're going to do and et cetera. But I'm just going to do it anyway. And I'm going to ask Bob to come in and introduce himself and give you a little bit about his background, and then we'll get right into our show today. Bob, how are you, sir?
I'm good. I am Bob Brunn. I am a former education writer with the Star Ledger of Newark, which is the state's largest newspaper, and I changed venues to my own blog 2 years ago, and I've been writing mostly about education, but I do write about other things, and mostly about New Jersey. But that's my background.
Don't forget the Pulitzer.
Well, I got a little piece of a Pulitzer, but I don't go around bragging about it because it was 145th of one. I was part of the team that that won the Pulitzer Prize for the Star Ledger back in 2004 or 5. I guess it was 2005 because it was about the resignation of James McGreevy as the governor in 2004.
Well, see, that's a biggie. I've never been nominated for a Pulitzer.
Well,
mainly
because
I can't even spell it, so that's probably why.
Well, it was an honor to be with a great newspaper, a great team, with a great paper, and I'm very pleased. But I'm not one of those people who goes around saying, you know, prize-winning journalist. I should be judged on what I do today, day by day, not by what prizes I won 10 years ago. So
that's why you can let me do it for you. Okay. All right. Something happened Friday.
All right.
Let's take us to that, or actually you can go back before that. How'd you get to Friday? The research path, the connection.
Well, I have, you know, over the years, of course, you know, I was a newspaper man for almost 50 years, just a year shy of 50 years. And over that time, of course, I had developed, you know, Jersey's a small state. We only have one state newspaper. And had developed sources and friends in education and other areas. And every now and then, one of them would pop up and say something. And in this case, I received a note saying, do you realize that the publisher of the statewide test in New Jersey, the PARC test, is notifying school districts, or a school, he only referred to one school district, notified the school district that someone had tweeted something about the test, and they called and demanded that, or Pearson called the state education department and demanded that they do something, and the department called the superintendent of schools in the district in question, which is Watchung Hills, and demanded that they punish the student. It turned out there were three students who were involved in some way, having their Twitters observed, scanned, monitored, spied on, whatever you want to call it, by Pearson. And since then, I've learned two more districts have. I know there are a lot out there. There are more districts, not only in New Jersey, but throughout the, I don't know the exact number of states. Is it 20 states that use Pearson? However, they have a tracking software that will pick up any reference to Park on Twitter, and they will look at it. And if they, what I don't know and what I haven't yet been able to find out is how they identify the Twitter with the student with the school district. Somewhere, somehow, and I've asked for Open Public Records Act information on this, somehow they are able to track a Twitter to a student and a student to a school, and then try to punish that student for whatever. I mean, the test means nothing in New Jersey for students. I mean, it's not a graduation test. It's not a promotion test. So it means nothing. So the kids have not taken it seriously. And some of them, in the case of Watchung Hills, I understand one of them wrote silly answers to some of the questions and took pictures of the silly answers, but because a word or two of the prompt or the question appeared in the picture, that was considered, taking pictures of the questions in a breach of test security. Now, unfortunately, I do not know all the details of what happened to the students or how they got identified, because the superintendent is saying she won't say anything more about it in order to protect the privacy of the students, which I find a tad ironic.
Ludicrous.
Ludicrous. Yeah, so, well, what they're basically saying is we are not saying what happened to these students to protect their privacy, which has just been violated by Pearson and the State Department of Education. So that's how I got the story, and I contacted the superintendent, I contacted the Department of Education, and I contacted Pearson. Pearson did not respond. The Department of Education, one of the people responded simply by kicking it upstairs, eventually I got no response from the department. But Elizabeth Drewitt, the superintendent of the Watchung Hills District, did respond, and she basically admitted that, that there were these incidents, and that she had taken care of them using her own local disciplinary code, judgment, whatever. So to me, it was a straight news story that, it was a revelation, as all journalists know, what's unusual is news. So I wrote a story saying, Pearson, the publisher of the Park tests in New Jersey, where tens of thousands of students were taking it, hundreds of thousands of students were taking it, has been spying, and it's the word I use, they use the word monitoring, on the Twitter accounts of the students who mention anything about the test, and then asking the state education department to ask the districts to punish those students for whatever they said. I've been reminded by people who are pro-Park, I guess, or pro-Pearson, that Twitter is public, which is true. However, I think there's a difference between, monitoring public and knowing how to identify those students in cooperation with a government agency and then seeking their punishment of those students. So it's just not simply, I'm looking at every tweet that mentions Pearson, or I'm looking at every tweet that mentions Park. It's the state and I, or state and Pearson, are spying on people, with the aim of perhaps punishing them and doing something to them that might affect their future.
What you just said in my intro, we talk about the corporate state elite and their Machiavellian agenda. And what you just explained is the corporate state elite nexus.
Right.
We now live in an America where the corporations are the government via their control over the White House, the Congress, the Senate, the state houses, the governors, the legislatures, the court system, both state and federal, in terms of the people that they have, so we say, I will say, bought and paid for. And now we have a situation where corporations actually supervise the government as opposed to the government supervising the corporation. There's the nexus there. So it's not surprising to me that Pearson would tell the State Department of Education, this is what we found, this is what we want you to do, and guess what? They get what they want.
And so yeah, they do.
That was not a surprise to me. I heard about what was going on Friday, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock, got a message saying, this was really sad, this was scary. I read it, and I said, you're right. This is 1984 all over again. And I said, be afraid, be very afraid. That picked up, and people started chiming in on, be afraid, be very afraid.
Yeah, really, yeah.
The new 1984. And from there, I started monitoring the traffic. It was nowhere near as heavy as I thought it should be in terms of people's awareness of it and being outraged. But it was a fairly good amount of people who were picking up the stories. That has continued over the 48-hour period involved. To today, there are people who are still coming in who are just becoming aware of it and et cetera.
Mm.
Let me ask you, when you wrote this piece, were you expecting the kind of reactions that have taken place?
Yeah.
Both by Pearson, the school district, and the public?
Yeah, let me start with the public first. I just so far, my site is still recovering from what happened. It's at 1.4 million hits on it, which I think the largest number of hits I've had before was about 20 or 30,000. So I have crashed several times. There was a point late Friday night, early Saturday morning, when my web host, a little operation called Green Geeks, shut down my site without talking to me. They shut it down, and I didn't know what happened because I got this very strange. You know, in the past, I've gotten an error message when I tried to get online or onto my site, which said resource capacity exhausted or something like that. And I understand that. You just wait a little while and you get back on. And that had happened. It happened fairly soon after I posted. I posted about 3 o'clock our time, about noontime, your time. And so I didn't think much of it. But then when I saw that the site had been suspended, and then people started emailing me and telling me that my site had been suspended, I got on my private email. And there were two messages from Green Geek saying that they had, in fact, suspended the site because of a denial of service attack, DOS, which, you know, Mr. Miller, I am not a techie. I didn't even know when they said it was a DOS attack. I had to write back then, what in the world is a DOS attack? Is it a Department of something, sanitation or something attack? So they said, no, denial of service attack. And please call us immediately and we can work this out. And they had sent me two messages. I didn't get the first one, wasn't even paying attention. Then as I talked to them on the phone, the guy I dealt with was convinced that somebody had launched an attack and that it had knocked down my site. And I got on Facebook and said, look, I don't know what's going on here, but my site is down. And I don't know. They weren't able to find out whether, in fact, and who it might be that launched an attack and was able to do it. And they're still looking, and they're supposed to get back to me. I don't know, and I can't. I'm not going to accuse Pearson. I don't know. I don't think that they would do that. I think they have enough money to hire lawyers to threaten me, much less knock my site down. I was able to post what I had on Facebook, and it was able to get out that way. So, and I know Diane Ravitch was kind enough to alert everybody to the fact that my site was down, and then I had been informed that it was a denial of service attack. I just don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't want to be vain enough to say, well, you know, so many people wanted to read it that it crashed the site. Maybe that's true. I just don't know.
Let me tell you my experience.
Okay.
I heard about it. I read about the possibility, the denial of service attack that was going on. And I sort of tried to monitor it. Not that I'm a techie or anything. People who come to the War Report, they know I don't know my butt from a hole in the ground.
Right.
But I knew enough about that to know that something was wrong. Yesterday, last night, I started trying to promote the show for today, and a lot of people were promoting it for me, and I noticed my computer started slowing down. And I've got a fast computer.
Right.
I mean, really fast computer here. And I cleaned out everything, and it was still like dirt slow.
Wow.
I tried to get on your site, and it took forever to the point where I just said, no, I'll try something else. That was last night. This morning, I think I slept like 4 hours. I got up at 6-something, and I tried to send out, I know what it was. Big Ed Ape had promoted today's show, and I tried to send that promotion to my own homepage on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And something popped up saying, no, you have possibly been spam attack. This is Facebook. This is Facebook telling me that they will not let me send this one piece from one of my sites to another one of my sites, and because it was possibly spam.
Mm.
And if you disagree with this, let us know. I sent them like a note saying, this is one big ass mistake. This is not spam, okay? I know the difference. I mean, I went on. It didn't change anything. Every time I tried to send that particular piece, it kept coming up as spam. So I'm thinking, no, I'm too small for anybody to want to stop me from doing what I'm doing. But mm-hmm. I started to connect it to the experience that you had. And I'm just wondering. That's why I raised the question about what you had experienced.
That was my reaction too. I'm too small. Why would they possibly come after me? I mean, this organization owns the Financial Times. It's 160 or 170 year old British corporation, with New Jersey alone 108 million plus contracts. Nationally it's over $1 billion that they'll be getting from testing. And why would they, want to mess with me? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think I am knowledgeable enough to know whether they would actually try to do that. I mean, I would consider it cyber warfare. I would consider it actionable. But I don't have any, hard evidence that it actually happened.
One of the big questions that I have, now it seems like you've been victimized. We know that the students are always victimized. We got two different set of victims here. Do you see yourself, one, as being victimized, and two, of the two groups, who has been victimized the most?
Well, that's a no-brainer. I do not view myself as being victimized. I have been a journalist for over 50 years. I have been sued by people who would try to suppress things that I published. I have been vilified by people on the left and on the right. And, it's just part of what I love about journalism. But clearly, students whose lives, whose futures are dependent upon policies and implementations of policies that appeared to be creating an odd system where public education, which was once the great equalizer, which was once the great advancer of all peoples in the United States, is now, you know, becoming a system in which they're hiring and maintaining only the youngest, least experienced teachers. They are relying primarily on standardized tests produced by others outside of their district, outside of their classroom, for purposes of classification, for purposes of punishment of teachers, doing things with the public school system that nobody ever intended, while at the same time creating a parallel privatized system. And I do a lot of writing about that in charter schools in Newark. Newark is trying to become like New Orleans, a model of charterization, of privatization. And these were, you know, it's creating a dual system where the privatized operation, the charter schools are going to be producing the executives, the 1%, the people who are making the bucks, and the public schools are going to be producing the drones. And it's my experience is mostly with urban districts, and it's kind of interesting to see the reaction of places like Watchung Hills, which is very affluent, and Hanover Park, which is also very, these are the towns where these things occurred. These are affluent, predominantly white school districts. And because they were the victims of this, this thing has gone national. But I can tell you that just a few weeks ago, I wrote about a cheating scandal in Newark in which nothing happened. I knew this was not Park. This is a local high school, not a local high school, a statewide high school test that was left over from previous years that had to be taken by students who hadn't passed it before. So there was a cheating scandal. Now, Newark is a state-run district. Newark is directly run, and this is in his own words, by the governor of the state, Chris Christie, who told the newly elected mayor, "You can say anything you want about Newark, but I am the decider." You may remember that use of that phrase by a different Republican politician years ago. He said, "I am the decider." He decides what happens in Newark. And what he has decided is that they are going to turn neighborhood public schools into warehouses for the least able students. They are going to skim the top for charter schools that are being run by corporations that have ties to the former education commissioner, Christopher Cerf. And, you know, this is an extraordinarily concerning and disturbing system. And we have a senator from New Jersey named Cory Booker, who used to be the mayor of Newark, who brought in the charters, who brought in Tammy Anderson, the current superintendent, and as a payback, Chris Christie manipulated the election laws so that Cory Booker could run virtually without opposition in the Democratic primary and become senator. Now, Christie is a Republican. Cory Booker is a Democrat. They were both backed by Wall Street, hedge fund people, because of their support for charter schools and vouchers. So, you know, the old Democrat versus Republican or liberal versus conservative, those kinds of that kind of framework doesn't work. You have to be talking here about people who favor a corporatized system of education versus those who believe that there's still a future for public education. Now, I've been denounced as a union lackey, you know, that I am loyal to unions. That would surprise, particularly the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, which sued me for libel for my book, Teachers in Power. They still don't like me for things that I say about teacher unions. And I am not opposed to teacher unions, but I have been critical of their leaders on occasion because I don't believe they are providing, hadn't provided the kind of leadership. I think they're waking up, but it may be too late.
I think you're being too kind. I think you're being too kind about their waking up.
They are waking up. They are waking
up. I'm persona non grata to the union.
They're waking up to realize that they may have given too much away. In Newark, they have given away merit pay. They have given away. We now have in Newark a corporate-based graduate school, which the superintendent in Newark has now identified as the only graduate program that Newark teachers can go to in order to get salary enhancement for graduate study. New Jersey had Rutgers Graduate School of Education, Seton Hall School of Education, Montclair State, Kane University, all these great programs. But teachers in Newark must go to Relay Graduate School of Education, which was started by charter school operators in New York and has a branch campus now in Newark.
That is happening in Tennessee as well and a few other states. We have a caller. Let's see if we can get this one on. Hello?
Hello, this is Andy calling from Rochester, New York. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, Andy, and how are you?
I'm doing great. First, I wanted to thank you both for bringing this issue to our attention. And I had a couple of questions for Bob.
Okay, go right ahead.
Sure. First, Bob, I'm wondering, before this story broke, I was fully convinced that I should honor my sixth grade son's request to participate in Pearson testing because he said that it gets him to think and he thinks that it's a good experience. But after reading your article, I'm just not comfortable with that decision. What would your advice be for parents of public school teachers after the experience that you've had these last 48 hours or so?
Parents of public school students. I would. You said public school teachers. You mean parents of public school students? I assume that's what you meant, right?
Right. I'm thinking of parents. I am a public school teacher, but I understand that we have certain legal requirements that would put us at risk. So I'm specifically asking this question from the public parent perspective.
I think, this is a new position for me, I had a very short learning curve, or very steep learning curve, I suppose, in the last 48 hours. But my advice would be to if you can, legally, because I never suggest people break the law, but if you can legally have your child opt out, I would, not so much because I think it's going to harm this child, but because I think that we have to reset the relationship with this testing program, because I think it has gone forward without accountability and without restraint for too long. And I think Pearson gets hurt for every student who doesn't take the test. In New Jersey, the fewer the students taking the test, the less amount of money the Pearson gets. I think at this point,
as well as the validity of the non-validity test.
Right.
It's compromised.
So I think, yes, and I think we have had thousands and thousands of people in New Jersey. We have a very strong opt-out movement in New Jersey, and they have expressed concern about what it's doing to federal funding, and they produced a letter by an assistant secretary of education, which basically said through NCLB, you have to come up, No Child Left Behind and its waiver, you have to come up with an assessment program that tests 95%. Well, that's true, but they don't have to come up with PARC. And New Jersey's had an assessment program, a local assessment program for, since the early 70s. I don't have a problem with assessment. I don't even have a problem with standards. I do have a problem with outsourcing this to a foreign corporation that has software packages developed to track students in New Jersey and in your state of New York, and find out what they're doing. I don't know what else they're finding out about students. I'd like to find out, and maybe I'm just being paranoid, but I think as a protest, opt-out is appropriate. it eventually will have to be widespread enough to affect the operation of schools. And we have a school in Newark, for example, which is nationally known, Science Park High School, where more than half of the teachers have signed a letter opposed to the test, and about 80% of the kids have opted out. So it's enough so that what happened is that the students who took the test had to be isolated instead of the students who didn't take the test had to be isolated and students there. The kids who did take the test were put into classrooms. I think this is really the only way that parents have of saying, look, no matter what we think of testing, no matter what we think of standards, we've got to stand back and say, wait, let's make sure that we're doing this rationally. Let's make sure we're doing it in a widespread. I mean, Park, my reading tells me, and I'm certainly not an expert, was put together basically behind closed doors. I don't think that's the appropriate way to put together a testing program, and I think it's time to stop. And New Jersey has a bill now putting a moratorium on any use of the Park test for 3 years, and I would hope that other states did that as well.
Let me insert something. There is a lot of chatter on Facebook and other sites, and one of the arguments that came out, I think, earlier today was that this fiasco will be one of the best things that could happen. Parents are going to be outraged, and more parents are going to opt their children out as a result of finding out about the surveillance that's going on. And so that Pearson has, in a sense, maybe shot itself in the foot, if not in the head, by this going public, which brings me back to you, Bob, by you exposing this, may have done a lot to spur what you just said, more people opting out, making the test more invalid than it already was.
Oh, I think
Carl, you have another question, because we have to move on.
Just one other question, and thank you so much. I really appreciate your thoughtful answers. My follow-up question is, as the two of you reflect upon this situation and the information that's come to light, do either of you see any parallels to previous experiences that we've had throughout history? I know that's very open-ended, but I'm just curious what the connections you see between what happened in the last 48 hours and what we've seen in the past.
Bob, let me take a shot at this.
Yeah, please, Jim. Yeah.
In terms of the last 48 hours, no. But if you meant throughout history, are there any parallels in terms of this massive use of high-stakes testing and with high consequences attached? I would say yes. Go back to the late 1890s and the early 1900s, a little thing called eugenics that led to the development of, quote, IQ tests that were given to almost every student child in the United States for probably 30, 40, 50 years running. And today's high-stakes testing regime has really grown out of the eugenics movement. Now, in terms of public's reaction, public being aware of it, now this is something new, I think, in terms of social media, grassroots media that Bob and I are involved in, and has made all the difference in the world. Bob, what do you have to say?
I immediately thought of Edward Snowden and the NSA revelation. And it's kind of interesting that and Snowden worked for a private company, too. And one of the things that always interested me and fascinated me about the whole NSA is how privy to the nation's most secret chambers of information are corporations like with Deloitte and Touche, I think, was the one that Edward Snowden worked for. I had friends who worked for Deloitte. I'm probably going to be criticized for overreaching here, but I the collapse of unions, the rise of the corporation, and the marriage, kind of the three-way marriage of corporations, what's left of unions, and government, reminds me of Italy in the 20s. You know, I know I'll be accused of being paranoid about it, but fascism...
The
rise of Mussolini, right. Fascism, the fascists were the bundles of wheat that were tied together and became a symbol for Mussolini because it was government, it was unions, and it was corporations that were tied together. Now, the difference, the big difference, I think, and I'm not a great student of modern European history, but is that the government was the strong partner in this. But the more we see, and this incident with New Jersey and Pearson, it strikes me that the corporations, and as you had said earlier in the show, Dr. Miller, the corporations are running the show instead of the government. And let us not forget that Pearson is not even an American corporation. It's a British corporation. It's a multinational corporation. It's a global corporation. And which is, perforce, because of its multinational character, unaccountable to anyone in a particular country. And it's accountable only to its shareholders. And that, to me, is pretty scary. I don't know if it answered
the
question.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. You were both doing such important work. And, I think my family is going to be opting out. Have a great afternoon, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Bob, in terms of the globalization that you just mentioned, my phrase, be afraid, be very afraid, that's part of what I was referring to. And on this show, I've talked many, many times about the globalized nature of the war on public education. We Americans tend to only know if we know anything about what's going on here or locally. No real awareness of what happened on the larger scale, global scale, happening in Europe, Asia, Africa, and et cetera. And the example of Pearson is just primo in terms of laying out the globalized nature of the reach of corporations, the nexus between corporations and state government, and their impact on, in this case, public education, but other social institutions, and bring it all the way down to the impact on our lives now and going forward. I've got one more question that I want to ask you about, and that is the attack on you. Do you see it in any way an attack on grassroots social media, individuals, groups? We're vulnerable.
Well, yes, we are. But let me again reiterate: I don't know whether, in fact, I was attacked. I think it's totally within the realm of possibility. But I also don't want to sound paranoid. But I think there's a slightly bigger issue, or maybe not slightly bigger, a bigger issue that I noticed as I was watching this unfold over the last 48 hours, and that is that. And maybe it's our fault, maybe it's not, I don't know. The credibility given to legitimate blogging sites by mainstream media is a kind of symptom, I don't know if I want to say symptomatic, but they spawn a contempt. I do what I do. I did the same thing when I was with the Star Ledger that I do now. I'm more, I am paid less, which means nothing because I don't take advertising. I'm living on a pension and and Social Security, so I do it for nothing. But I do what I do, and I do it well, I think. I mean, if I ever made a mistake, I made one mistake, which won't bore you with the details, back about a year and a half ago. I owned up and I apologized for it, which is a lot more than I remember my newspaper doing when we made mistakes. I think that I have standards as high, if not higher, than the newspaper I once worked for and other medium. But, you know, my story
started generating a lot of attention, but really hit the roof when Valerie Strauss at the Washington Post, whom, by the way, I respect enormously, wrote about. And I think that's fine. I mean, I'm glad she did, and it certainly gave a lot more distribution to my story. But the point was, it took, now this is Sunday afternoon, so it's 48 hours later, my local newspaper, which I know covers Watchung Hills and Hanover Park and other districts that this is involved in, won't touch the story. And I think it won't touch the story because it doesn't trust bloggers, even if it's somebody that they sent a paycheck to for 50 years. And so, and by doing that, I think the mainstream media, which of course has its own problems dealing with the internet, tries to breed contempt for blogging. And some of the blogs I've seen, some of the stories that I've seen out of the internet, go far beyond. I mean, far beyond things that the conventional press does. And you know, the whole notion of citizen participation. People have been asking me what to do, what they should do, and I said, look, you are my sources. I don't rely on public relations people. There was I mentioned it in one of the first blog I wrote about this. There was a media session by the State Department of Education on the park tests last week. I am credentialed by the State Police of New Jersey. I am credentialed by New Jersey Press Association. I am credentialed by the State House. I was not invited. I was not invited. Maybe it's because I am who I am, or maybe it's because I'm a blogger. I don't know. But the point is, and I, you know, I'm just kind of glad that I wasn't invited because I saw the stories that were generated by this. And even though they spent hours with the press talking, with the mainstream press talking about it, they never even brought up the notion of pet security and surveillance or anything else. So I think that mainstream media tends to despise us and breed contempt for us. And that is dangerous because it's people like, I'm not going to say me, it's people like you and so many other people out there who raise these issues that mainstream media, which is after all part of this corporation, I mean, you know, you never know what newspaper might be owned by Pearson.
Right. We know that all of the major media outlets are owned by six corporations.
Right.
And so what we do as grassroots media may have a limited impact, but we still have an impact. And what you do, of course, because of your reputation, is huge for us. And that's why I asked the question in terms of attack on you. Was it also, I believe, an attack on all of us? If they would attack you, they will definitely attack me.
Oh yeah, I think if they could, they would. I don't want to be far. I don't want to be ahead of the story because I don't know. Certainly,
I know. I can go there. You don't have to. I go there for both
okay.
of us.
Okay.
I'm going to have to say a halt to this part of the show. I have a dedication that I need to do, and I only have a few minutes left to do it. So if you don't mind, you can either stay on and listen, or you and I can try and do something like this again in the future.
I've got to get off because actually I've got another radio show to do in a few minutes, and I much
right,
appreciate
it. With Tim. I know. You got Tim
still
coming
on.
Up.
Yes, right.
Right.
So okay. Please let me take a breath and have a cup of coffee, and I can be on the air with him. But please invite me back. I'd love to talk to you again.
You got a deal, man. Talk to you
okay.
later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay. Well, folks, for those of you who are regulars to the show, who also come to my Facebook group, you'll know that midweek this past week, Luciana Sanson said that she had to leave both the radio show and the group. And it was a surprise to all of us. And I had some time to reflect on it and thought that I should dedicate this show to her and tell you why. Let me start by saying how I met Lucy. When I first got on Facebook, my regulars know that I don't know anything about internet and social media, what have you. I joined several groups, and I started getting hundreds of posts during the day. As I was reading all the various posts from different groups and what have you, I started noticing there were certain people who were doing research within the parameters that I set for myself. I liked their work. I started saving, creating files for these people and what have you. Lucy was one of those people. I liked her work, and I began to trust and respect her work. After about, I don't know, a month or so, the Ferguson incident came about when young Mike Brown was shot and killed. Lucy wrote a very powerful but short statement, and it goes something like, "Hey, white people, I'm talking to you. I'm a white Southern woman." That piece blew my mind. I want to know, who is this woman? She's in a red state. She is calling out white people. White people are going to be all over her. She is one of the most brave and courageous people I have come to know something about. So I tracked her down, and I tried to invite her to the show. And I sent her an email. Well, today everyone does Facebook's thing, and no one goes to email. She didn't get it. She didn't come on the show. A couple of days after the show, she got in touch with me saying that she hadn't gotten it because what I just said, and that she would love to come on the show. I brought her on the show. That led to her coming back, and then back again. I brought her back as a special guest co-host, and a relationship developed in terms of her making me and the rest of us aware about what was going on in Tennessee and other red states. Sometime in the fall, she became available in terms of wanting to continue her activism, but in another setting. And I invited her to come on to the War Report. And it was one of the best decisions that I've made in a long time. She came on, and she just went ballistic. She has taken the War Report from where it was to new heights. She created a profile for us that has spread rather widely. She, in her time here, which was only a few months, she created the Facebook public group by the same name, the War Report on Public Education, a blog. She became very active on Twitter, Instagram, you name it, networking, connecting us with other groups and individuals. She was just phenomenal for the War Report. And I could only say that once she joined us, we became instantly better at what we're doing. And she has had an impression on us that will never disappear. And I also want to say some of the things that she did, as I mentioned. Networking. Awesome networker. She has a vision for taking us to the next level. She has a vision of what our potential could be. And most importantly, all my weaknesses were and are her strengths. Together, we made an awesome team. She brought in another individual, making us a three-person team, the War Report team, our Team War Report. She has just been beyond phenomenal for the War Report and for me. And her departure was something that I don't think we'll ever recover from. There's no replacing a Lucy. She is rather unique, both as an individual and as a person involved in this war. I can tell you she's second generation public school teacher. She is passionate as you can get about public education and our students. She will go to bat for students. She will go to war for students. She has a dedication that, boy, I won't say unparalleled, but it is unparalleled in my view. And I can't even tell you about all the things that she is unparalleled. That is a big statement. I know it. It's also a bias, for sure, and I am biased. But let me also say something, too, about Lucy the person. When she came to the War Report was like a port in a storm. She was exiting a storm, found safe haven at the War Report, a place where she could be herself, be the person she wanted to be the activist that she wanted to be, and the advocate on the right side of the war. As I said, she brought these tremendous social media skills, networking skills, the vision, et cetera. And it was here that she was able to reflect on the past, reflect on the present, and envision her future going forward. So there was a symbiotic relationship in that she did so much for us, but also we was what she needed at the time. And as a result, I think she has benefited from the relationship here. And one of the more things that I'm super, super pleased about, in the last couple of months, she and I have had many talks, and she has said to me that things were beginning to fall in place for her and that she could begin to see clearly now that, I call it, the storm has gone. And I referenced a song to her. I said, you know, you're talking about a song. So let me finish up by saying, Lucy, I took that song and I did a little rewriting on it, and it goes something like this. You can see clearly now that the storm, the rain has gone. You see all the obstacles in your way. Gone are the dark clouds that had you blind. Lucy, it's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. Yes, Lucy, you can make it now. All the obstacles are falling by the wayside. It's going to be a bright, sunny day. And Lucy, I know you have gotten some of your dreams. You want to go back to school. That's happening. You also have your Celtic connection from your English, being an English teacher. You say you have Celtic blood, and you may have plans to take your Celtic connection to Ireland, and where I say, yes, the grass may be greener there, and you may get a chance to touch the leprechaun, and you may engage in high ceremony, and et cetera, and that I truly hope that the grass is greener for you wherever you go, and that the Celtic connection that you want to reestablish works for you, and that the sunshine that you see is a rainbow, and that rainbow will lead to that pot of gold that you've been seeking. That's a sort of condensed version of a 3-page thing that I wrote, stayed up all night again doing this. But with that, I have to go. And Lucy, wherever you are, hope you find the pot of gold at the end of that Celtic rainbow that you're seeking. Good evening, everyone. Back with you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.